at times, it costs them their lives. I mean, that is what's so deeply humbling to us, is that these organizations are going to the ends of the earth trying to help, you know, vulnerable children or marginalized populations, you know, fighting on their behalf or providing aid and assistance under, frankly, some of the most dangerous and hostile environments.
Welcome to an Encore podcast presentation from Forbes Books at ForbesBooks.com.
I'm here with Daryl Connor and Ed Boswell. Daryl is the chairman and Ed is the CEO. They're both the co-founders of Connor Advisory, ConnorAdvisory.com. And we are going to have a very deep and interesting conversation. And I say that just based on a statement that is at the head of their website that says, Connor Advisory serves organizations pursuing changes that matter. Changes that matter, those words highlighted. Initiatives that have the potential to profoundly improve the lives of millions of people around the world. Daryl and Ed, welcome. And that is, that's a lot of weight to put on the two shoulders of you guys as the co-founders of Connor Advisory. Welcome, and tell us about Connor Advisory and the work you're doing.
Sure. This is Daryl. And what led to that is Ed and I spent many years serving corporate America, in large corporations in other countries as well, helping them implement major change projects. And we established Connor Advisory now close to 5 years ago. And one of the things that really brought us together was we each had been involved in many projects, all of them honorable, and many of them producing some really interesting results. But we weren't sure that all of them actually made a difference in the human experience in a positive way. And what we had in common was that we had kind of both reached a point where that's what we wanted to do with the remaining years that we could practice this craft, was to devote what we had learned about implementing change and apply it to organizations that their purpose was to actually make a difference in how humans live their lives. So that's what brought us together.
And so can you give us some examples of the kinds of organizations those are that you have worked with, or even the kinds of organizations that you envisioned yourselves working with when you first launched about 5 years ago?
Sure. Yeah. This is Ed. So when we first started out, our definition was fairly broad. We had done some work, some pro bono work in during our careers with nonprofits. But what we found was there was this whole universe of, I guess, what they call civil society institutions, NGOs, local nonprofits, charities that are all striving, you know, to make some kind of difference, sometimes on a global scale, sometimes just at the local community level. But one thing that we found that was very interesting is that by and large, that sector, the civil society sector, actually does a pretty good job of making changes in society. They transform lives or communities and they're there during disasters, and they're there to help, you know, economic development, human rights, and all that. But one of the interesting ironies that we discovered is that when it comes to making changes themselves as organizations so that they can do their work with even more impact, with more effectiveness, sometimes they stumble. So that was the irony. They can make an impact on the world, but when it comes to having to change themselves, they sometimes, those skills and the experience aren't transferable. So what we found is that we were being pulled in initially from our pro bono work into more and more work in the nonprofit area. And in fact, I would say over the last 4 or 5 years that Daryl and I have been active in this work, most of our clients are CEOs or board chairs of fairly large international NGOs that, you know, many of your listeners would be familiar with.
Are you allowed to mention their names?
Yeah, you can go to our website and see. Absolutely. So it's organizations like Habitat for Humanity International or World Vision International, organizations like that, Doctors Without Borders. Daryl, you want to mention a few?
PAC is an NGO that really does some interesting work worldwide, Lutheran World Relief. there's just a number of organizations that we've been fortunate enough to work with. Now, let's be clear, Ed and I do not provide any guidance around what these organizations should be changing. Mm-hmm. They come to us when they're pretty clear about what they need to do differently. What they're seeking is, how do you actually execute this change that we've now determined we need to make? How do you execute the change? How do you implement the change in such a way so that you reach the full value of what it's intended to do? As Ed said, this sector has a track record of just doing accomplishing phenomenal change with those they serve, but not so skilled at implementing the changes internally that they need in order to continue serving those people. And so that's the nature of the work, and that's the sort of organizations that we're involved in.
It's a fascinating, almost niche of a niche that you've discovered here. And I'm wondering, do you find that in doing this kind of work and working with these kinds of organizations, do you find that maybe you were the first to really identify this as a special place that needed first to be identified and then to have the kind of support that you're providing? Because what's coming to mind as I'm listening to you is I'm thinking that what the two of you have actually created with Connor Advisory is you're actually change makers for change makers.
Yes, but I don't think that, you know, I don't, by no means are we the only ones that have attempted to provide this kind of support. Many of the large consulting firms have either individual practitioners that are involved in this kind of work or are supporting NGOs. Sometimes there's whole practices that focus in on it. Now, the difference, I think, for us is those organizations are providing a range of services. So they might be helping them with tax and audit. They might be helping them with mergers and acquisition support. There's a whole range of services they provide.
Yes.
As far as Ed and I know, we may be the only ones that have built an organization completely dedicated to just the implementation of change. So in that sense, yeah, you may be right, although there may be some out there that we're just unaware of. But certainly there's plenty of consulting firms that have chosen to either part-time or even full-time apply some of their expertise to the nonprofit and the NGO sector. As you said, we kind of have a niche of a niche here.
But it also sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, although if you deny this, I'll be stunned because I don't think anybody ever would. It sounds like this for both of you at this time in your lives is more personal than building businesses or collecting clients. I mean, if you go to one of the large consulting firms, you're another client. There's nothing wrong with that. But it sounds to me like this is really, it has been a personal advocation for the two of you.
I think that's right. Both of us spent our years building large consulting organizations. And in fact, I was part of one of the big four advisory services. And so we've lived that life. And of course, that's where we gained a lot of experience and honed our skills. But you're right, there is something deeply personal about this work. When you think about the men and women who are attracted to these organizations, and many of them, they're certainly not making all the money they could make in the private sector. They're certainly not getting all the glory they could probably get pursuing other careers. But what they're getting is a deep satisfaction that they're making a difference. And at times, it costs them their lives. I mean, that is what's so deeply humbling to us, is that these organizations are going to the ends of the earth trying to help, you know, vulnerable children or marginalized populations, you know, fighting on their behalf or providing aid and assistance under, frankly, some of the most dangerous and hostile environments. I mean, when you think about one well-known group, the White Helmets in Syria, that they race towards the bombing. They don't run away from it. And so to support organizations that are providing, you know, their expertise and their manpower and their money and technology to help is just, for us, there was just no other choice. It's almost as if this is what we were destined to do at this point in our careers. Mm. And, you know, the idea of being a niche of a niche, just to add to that, we are very, very selective, and we only work with the leadership team, the CEO or the managing director, the secretary general, and often the board chairs, because we find that that's the nexus of if you're going to do any kind of transformational change, it does have to start at the top. And so we really do restrict our work to working with the decision makers that can really make a difference for their organizations.
What I would add to that is I'll underline the restrict reference that Ed just made. I feel really fortunate that Ed and I found each other at the time we did in our careers, because we both have many years establishing and growing consulting firms. And so we know what that's all about. And there's, you know, a lot of pressure for the economic advancement and all that. We had separately reached a point, and we found that out when we began to dialogue, where that was fine, been there, done that. What we wanted to do now was not sit on top of a large organization where other consultants were deployed. We both actually wanted to provide the service ourselves. Mm. And what that means is that we actually are not committed at all to growing the firm. We don't intend on having a lot of other partners. It's Ed and I, and we occasionally will bring in some folks to help us, but we only take on assignments that Ed and I can take on because we want to personally deliver the work. And so we are fairly restrictive. In fact, I about who we take on, I was introduced last week by a CEO that we've worked with for quite a while. He was introducing me to some other people, and he said, you know, one of the things that got my attention about Daryl when I first met him was I thought we were having an interview where I was interviewing him to see if we wanted to work with him. And I ended up feeling like he was interviewing me to see whether he would work with us. And that's actually, I mean, Ed and I have those conversations. Is this an organization that we really can provide value to? But is it one that kind of fits this niche of a niche where it's only the two of us and we only have, you know, a limited amount of capacity? And so I really feel fortunate that there's a number of organizations that fit into that profile.
So, Ed, you in particular, you have a background with, as you mentioned, a very large consulting firm, right? PwC. And talk a little bit about how the work you're doing now with Connor Advisory is just structurally different than the work you were doing for PwC and how that is for you personally.
Sure. Well, it was a big change because and this isn't unique to PwC. It's generally the large consulting firms. When we would win a big engagement, you know, the first thing you do is mobilize a large team. And that team, you know, spends Monday through Thursday of every week, you know, on site with the client doing a lot of the work. What is different about this work is, as Daryl said, we're advising the CEO, his or her executive team, his or her board. And so it's much more of an advisory role that we're playing versus, you know, in the army of people. Now, there are times when the work with some of these very large global charities or NGOs does require more than just Daryl or more than just Ed and Daryl combined. So we do have a network of associates that we've worked with in the past that we know and just deeply trust, you know, their capabilities and their judgment. And so we will flex to bring in a team when it's required. But the biggest change is that we really are having a one-on-one kind of relationship with the CEO. And this is probably the biggest filter for Daryl and myself. We realize that when a leader wants to transform their organization, they have to go through a transformation themselves. They need to adopt new mindsets. They need to exhibit new behaviors that are consistent with the change, the new organization that they're trying to create. And so we're looking for leaders, executives who are open to that, appreciate that they've got to go through the transformation first before they ask anyone else to do it. And they realize that it won't be easy. And so they're looking for that kind of help. So it is, I have to say, just deeply humbling to have these intimate relationships with these leaders as they go through their own journey of trying to change, because they know they desperately need, their organization desperately needs to change to continue to have the kind of impact that they're having on the world. I mean, we're not talking about generating another, you know, $500 million in profits next quarter. We're talking about perhaps children's lives, or the lives of a whole, you know, community, or the, you know, the well-being of a whole generation of young girls or something like that. So the stakes are really, really high. So I would say that's another big difference. When we were doing work in the public and private sphere, the metrics, what was success, while very ambitious, were of a whole different category when you're talking about the quality of human life.
So you actually raise a really interesting question. I'm talking with Daryl Connor, he's the chairman, and Ed Boswell, he's the CEO of Connor Advisory. They're at ConnorAdvisory.com. When you describe that kind of relationship that you now have with the leaders of these NGOs and nonprofits, this may be a naive question, but thank you for answering it anyway. First, I want to point out that you were actually a partner at PwC and you led the U.S. People and Change consulting practice. So you were at the highest level, or very close to the highest level, within PwC. So you've seen it all. Mm-hmm. Now, when you work with these leaders within these NGOs and these nonprofits, and you understand and help them understand that for the organization to change, they must change as well, or as you said, go through their own journey. Mm-hmm. Was that part of the work that you and your team would do at PwC, or is that a complete sea change in the kind of work you're doing?
For me personally, it's a complete sea change. Because I think that a lot of the work that I was involved in, and not just at PwC, but when I was the CEO of a Boston-based consultancy, the Forum Corporation, I think that a lot of those relationships, as deep as they were between me and my team and our client, were usually restricted to what they were doing. Mm-hmm. You know, what strategy they were trying to implement, what processes, what technology they were implementing, and the like. The conversations that Daryl and I have with our clients are not always about the what, it's about who you are as a leader. And so qualitatively, that's the biggest shift that I could point to, is moving from mainly concentrating on what your client should do and telling them, to now exploring who they are and how they use who they are to forward the mission of their charity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes complete sense. And it raises another question, which is you tell me if this is a fair question. Can we dig into why change is hard for these kinds of organizations? And are there lessons that all of us can learn from why the change is hard for them?
Yeah, there are lessons. We've collectively, Ed and I, have got decades of identifying patterns associated with success and failure of change. Early on, the early research that we were involved in was here in the U.S. We identified patterns around how and when is commitment generated toward change. There's different patterns of behavior and mindsets around when and how does resistance surface. How does the change impact the culture of the organization? When is change simply too much for people to absorb? Well, there's patterns to this. And to our surprise, we found out that these are not US-based patterns. We found the same patterns in all of the other countries that we've worked in. So it's actually not how US organizations change, it's how humans deal with transition. And so one way to view the work is that we share these patterns, and now there's over 40 years of our research behind this now. So we can share what the patterns are, what leads to success, where are the pitfalls, and then we provide guidance about how do you replicate the success patterns, and how do you avoid these downside patterns. Now, to Ed's point, some of that has to do with, you know, what kind of activities that you're involved in. We have developed diagnostic tools over the years, and there's various procedures that can be applied to help people increase commitment and better deal with the resistance and make sure they don't overload the culture and stuff like that. But at the heart of all that is the leader has to come to grips with him or herself. And what do they have to do differently in order to engage those patterns? And so, yes, there are patterns. It actually, for many clients, looks, kind of like, how in the world how could you so quickly determine what our problems were? Well, you spend 4 decades looking at the problems, and there's a signature pattern, and it does. Maybe there's 16 steps to a pattern, and Ed and I can kind of pick up after 3 steps what's going on, and by sharing that with people. And more importantly, and here's how you leverage the success pattern, and here's how you mitigate the negative patterns. Mm. That's really the value that we bring.
So how does this relationship with an NGO or a nonprofit start? Is it typically that a word of mouth where they've heard of you from somewhere else and they reach out to you? Or do you actively look for organizations that are of interest to the two of you? What's the process there?
Well, one of the things that's very different from both of our previous careers is I think we both spent a good bit of time seeking new client relationships in our past lives.
Yes.
This is not a sector where you market. This is not a sector where you take out ads or this is a very intimate closed loop, if you will. And so our relationships really have developed because of one CEO talking to another, or one CEO and asking us to come in and speak at a conference or whatever. And so the relationships begin there, and whether that be, somebody would ask us to have lunch with somebody else, or maybe we do a keynote address to a group of NGO leaders. At some point, then that opens up into a dialogue about a potential relationship. And it's not uncommon. This isn't always the pattern, but oftentimes what happens is a leader will say, "Gee, I really find all these patterns of success are really interesting. Can you come in and share those patterns with my leadership team?" And many times that's the first thing and the only thing that we originally agreed to is, yeah, we'll come in and share those patterns. And sometimes maybe that's all that they're interested in. But oftentimes they'll say, well, these patterns were great. Like, how do we apply the patterns? And so maybe the next step is to collect some diagnostic through interviews and focus groups, whatever, collect some diagnostic information about, well, which of these patterns might be causing some implementation inhibitors, which ones are you seems to be leveraging well, and come back to them and say, all right, here's your prognosis based on your use of these patterns, even though you weren't aware of them, they're still in place. Here's your prognosis, and here's some ways that you might strengthen it. And sometimes that's all we do is diagnose for them. And they go, gee, thanks a lot. This is really helpful. Then other times they'll say, can you partner with us to help us implement these patterns? So there's a series of stages, if you will, that organizations go through, and we're happy to serve them at each stage. I mean, Ed and I do a lot of writing about what we've learned around change in the civil society sector. And some organizations, the value they receive from us is they simply read the papers that we make available for free on our website. And it kind of move, it might move on from there.
And are you able to summarize how many engagements you might do in a year? I'm really asking because if I'm with an NGO or a nonprofit and I'm thinking, boy, I really want to reach out to these guys, I kind of want to get a sense of whether it makes sense for me to do that or not.
Sure. So, Greg, I think a typical year, we're probably involved in a handful of engagements, 6 engagements or so. At any given time, and understand that those engagements are at different points of maturity. So in some cases, we'll be wrapping up maybe a 6-month or 1-year engagement with one organization, and others we're just starting the diagnostic phase. So at any given time, Daryl and I are looking at essentially a portfolio of relationships that we've got with NGOs and moving them along, you know, at the pace that's appropriate for them. So right now, capacity has not been an issue. And when we are tight on capacity, as I said, we've got a network of associates that we can bring in to help fill in the gaps.
And do you find that there's a best size or size range for you in terms of organizations that are appropriate for you to work with?
You know what I think is even more important than size, Greg, is it's the predisposition of the leader and the circumstance that he or she finds themselves in. So we are best, we provide our best value for leaders who understand that their organization has to make a pretty substantial leap. We call these transformational changes as opposed to incremental changes. We also find that our work is best done with leaders who realize they can't just install a change. They actually have to realize the impact of that change. And then third, we're looking for leaders that understand that the change, it's not only an imperative, an organizational or business imperative, it's almost a personal imperative. You know, it's like failure is just not an option on their watch. And so I would say that Daryl and I focus less on the size of the NGO, because we've worked with NGOs that are over $2 billion in annual donations and revenues, and others that are under $10 million. So that's a big range. The key is the predisposition of the leader and the circumstance that he or she finds themselves in. That's the big gating factor for us.
I want to ask you both one more question. I'm talking with Daryl Connor and Ed Boswell. Daryl's the chairman. Ed is the CEO of Connor Advisory. They're at ConnorAdvisory.com. I want to ask you a question to kind of bring this home for everyone, even those who are listening who are not in the nonprofit or NGO world, because the two of you have had such successful careers in business and helping first businesses and organizations make these kind of changes, and now really focused on nonprofits and NGOs. Is there, from each of you, is there one tidbit of guidance or advice from all those years of experience you have that you'd like to share with everyone, whether they're in the NGO world or the nonprofit world or not?
I would say, first off, Greg, I had the privilege of actually running a large organization, as I said, in Boston, and I had to affect change in my organization. In fact, rather dramatic, transformational change. So I've been fortunate in my career to not only advise CEOs of great organizations, but also be a CEO myself. And I think that the lesson that I've learned from all of those experiences, and the one that continues to resonate with a lot of our clients, is the power of dialogue with your team, your staff, and all your stakeholders. It is amazing the power of just spending time, not in your office, but with your staff, with your customers, in the case of NGOs, with your beneficiaries or your donors, and listening and asking. I think the characteristic that stands out for me about effective leaders is they're intensely curious. They ask many more questions than they spend time making assertions. So that idea of listening, and then when it does come time to communicating the change, having the patience to sit down with groups one-on-one and just take the time to help people appreciate that the status quo is no longer sustainable. We must change so that in order for us to continue to do our good work. So again, I want to come back to, it's just the power of conversation and dialogue. And I think that a lot of us as leaders, sometimes we can hide behind our titles, hide behind our desk, hide in our offices, and that's the death knell.
Well said.
So for me, if I had to pick just one thing, Greg, I would say it's probably a surprise to some people. Ed and I are actually not advocates for change, even though we're in the change business. We're advocates for, if you change, do it right. My first advice actually to the leaders is, unless you really need to engage this transformation, if I were you, I wouldn't do it. Transformation is hard and messy and risky, and quite frankly, many of the endeavors that we're asked to help with, they're good ideas, but they're not real imperatives, and typically they don't go very far. And so my guidance, if I could only offer one bit of advice to leaders, is be very attentive to whether or not transformational change is really necessary. And if it's not, then look at it from more of an incremental standpoint. But when transformation is critical, it's an absolute imperative for the organization and for you as a leader, then if you're going to enter into that journey, then do everything possible to adhere to what decades of research shows are the success patterns. So if you're going to engage change, engage it in a way that dramatically increases the likelihood you're going to reach realization. So that would be my guidance.
And I just want to point out that you're talking in this case about organizations in terms of the work you're both doing today, where the stakes are so incredibly high. I mean, as you said, yeah. I mean, often the stakes are human lives, many human lives.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Now, that said, I was with a group recently where their challenge was every single thing that they had in front of them. There were several transformations. Every one of them, Greg, could be justified because they would have at least a positive, if not a significantly positive impact on human life, even saving lives. And yet that organization could not absorb all of them. It could not do all of them. It actually had to make a very tough decision about what lives are we not going to save in order for us to be able to save the lives in this other area. It was excruciating. Now, that is an example of a pattern. Many NGOs, they don't follow that pattern. They try to say yes to everything, and they actually jeopardize their ability to implement change everywhere. This organization chose to exercise the discipline to follow the pattern, which is of all the things we really want to do, which ones are the most crucial, and let's make sure we implement those changes well.
And that's as essential a lesson for all businesses, not just NGOs
exactly.
And nonprofits, right?
Exactly.
I mean, there's a lot of people in the yep. C-suite who have a hard time saying no.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Wow. Beautifully said. They are Daryl Connor. He's the chairman, Ed Boswell, the CEO of Connor Advisory, ConnorAdvisory.com. I highly recommend a visit to their website. There's a lot of great information there, including some of their research available. Reach out to them, of course, if you think it's appropriate. But I want to thank you both for joining us. It's really been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank
I really
you, Greg.
Enjoyed it as well.
Thank you for listening to this Encore podcast presentation from Forbes Books at ForbesBooks.com.